Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Nimmer's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Hello and welcome to Season 4, Episode 1 of Naylor's Natter. And these special summer episodes are recorded to be enjoyed, hopefully while teachers are relaxing on a sun lounger, taking a gentle walk in the park, or driving your children round to various summer activities. So this week's guest needs little introduction, but I'm going to make sure he gets one anyway. So Thomas R. Guskey is a senior research scholar in the College of Education and Human Development at the University of Louisville, and Professor Emeritus in the College of Education at the University of Kentucky. And Tom is a graduate of the University of Chicago and began his career in education as a middle school teacher, serving as an administrator in the Chicago Public Schools, and was the first director of the Center for Improvement of Teaching and Learning, a national research center. Dr. Guskey is the author or editor of 25 award-winning books and more than 250 book chapters, articles and professional papers on educational measurement, evaluation, assessment, grading and professional learning. And his articles have appeared in prominent research journals all around the world. So in this episode, we're going to talk about professional development and its importance in the current educational landscape, both here in the UK and further afield. We touch on Ofsted, the EEF's implementation guide, and the work of the Teacher Development Trust. And the real focus of our discussion is on his seminal research paper, Does It Make a Difference? Evaluating Professional Development. So sit back, order another pina colada, and get ready for this week's conversation. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
And thank you again for giving up your time. Really, really appreciate it. The focus of this podcast over here in the UK is we're trying to do sort of evidence-based and continuing professional development podcast for teachers. And your work's really, really important to a lot of what is going on in the UK at the minute. So people are very aware of particularly your paper on Does It Make a Difference? Evaluating Professional Development is used quite a lot. But for those that are not as familiar, would you be able to give us a little bit of a sort of history of your career to this point and what kind of things you're working on at the moment?
Certainly, I'd be pleased to. In fact, I'm surprised with all that's going on in Britain at this time that there's so much interest in education.
Well, there might be a little bit more interest in education now as our new Prime Minister is making that one of his big priorities as we speak. So, yes, that could be an interesting time.
That's an excellent point. Sure. Well, let me tell you a bit about my background. I actually began in education as a middle grade teacher, grade 7 and 8. Came into it quite by chance, but fell in love with working with young people, and I was a mathematics teacher. Returned to graduate school really to learn how to become a better teacher. My graduate training began in the city of Boston, and then I moved from there to begin a program at the University of Chicago, where my advisor and the chair of my doctoral dissertation was Benjamin Bloom. So it was Bloom's influence that really got me interested in the notion of assessment and keeping track of students and then evaluation. So my doctoral dissertation work focused more on teacher change. I was working at that time as an administrator in the Chicago Public Schools and engaged in a lot of professional learning opportunities for the teachers there, and became fascinated by this entire change process. That then led me to think more about professional learning experiences for educators, and then how we evaluate those to determine whether they're accomplishing what we set out to accomplish and if they were really leading to the positive results we had hoped. So that was my initial exploration in that area, and then since then have been able to, through my university position, do many studies on the process of teacher change, what prompts them to change, what are the things that inhibit that change process, and have been able then to refine and add to the model since then.
Wow, fantastic, fantastic. And there's so much to talk to you about, and I know that a lot of people that I've interacted with on social media and through the work that we're doing over here have asked me to ask numerous questions, but I wanted to kind of focus in a little bit about professional development. There was quite a call as well to ask a little bit more about the mastery and sort of some papers that you did there and some of that area, but we'll just try and focus pretty much onto professional development, if that's okay.
Okay, that would be fine, yes.
Wonderful. So if I just start with sort of a general question. So schools in England are using your model for professional development, so the model involving the five-level model. Could you tell listeners a little bit about how that model came about and maybe a little bit of a description about each of those levels?
Yes. When I first began working in a more dedicated fashion in the area of professional learning for educators, professional development programs in particular, we were concerned about how to determine their effects. And I'd done some background investigations and had come upon a model developed by Donald Kirkpatrick. Kirkpatrick wrote in the 1950s about evaluating professional development programs, but primarily in business and industry. Kirkpatrick developed a model that looked at four different levels or types of outcomes we could consider. And he labeled those reaction, learning, behavior, and the results. So reaction was just how the employees would regard the training. Learning was what they actually developed from it, the new skills in particular that they developed. Behavior had to do with their on-the-job performance, and the results from Kirkpatrick's model focused primarily on the improvement in productivity. So I wrote initially about applying that to professional learning programs for educators. And we did that for several years, but found that the model itself was a bit deficient. There were things happening that were not explained by the model, evidence that we were not able to gather that seemed to have strong bearing on whether it was leading to the outcomes we had hoped. So that brought my attention to focusing on the organization itself. We found many times we were doing things right from a training perspective, but then send people back into organizations that were not set up to support them to do the things we were asking to do. So that led me to then add this level three in the model, kind of in the middle of things, that looked beyond the individuals to the organization in which they would be implementing these ideas. So the five-level model that sort of I refined based on Kirkpatrick's work dealt with the reactions, how people regard that initial training experience or their learning experiences. Second is the learning, what they gain, how it influences their knowledge and the skills that they have. Third is organization support and change. Is the organization set up to provide an environment conducive to their implementation? Do they have the support that they need? That support broadly defined to include things such as time, materials, technology, administrative support, all those kinds of things. Level four dealt with implementation. Did they use these ideas and use them with fidelity? And then finally, we looked at the impact on students. And I pressed very hard from the very beginning to make sure that when we looked at the impact on students, that we defined that very broadly, not only to include assessment results, but to think about all the other things that matter to teachers in working with their students. So are their students more confident in learning situations? Do they feel better about themselves as learners? Are they attending school on a more regular basis? All these sort of affective and behavioral things that are important in an educational realm that would be included in the student learning outcomes we'd consider as a part of that professional learning experience.
Brilliant. And I mean, this is just fascinating stuff. So in terms of the roles that I've got over here, and obviously some of the listeners are aware of this, we're responsible through an organisation called the Teacher Development Trust. I don't know, are you aware of the Teacher Development Trust's work over here in the UK?
Yes, I've been following that work pretty closely.
Brilliant. So David Weston, who heads that up, has set up what we call a CPD hub, which are running across various different parts of the UK, and I'm responsible for leading one of those in Blackpool. So we work across many different schools on planning their professional learning and their professional development. But what interested people when we started to work with them about this model that you've been talking about there is the idea that in planning professional development, the order of these levels should be reversed. And you must almost plan backwards. So you could tell us a little bit about the thinking behind that sort of backwards planning.
Yes, of course. When I have the opportunity to work with educators on the application of the model, I stress that there are two major learnings I hope that they gather from that experience. The first is that all five of these levels in the model are important, and none can be neglected. Each involves very different kinds of evidence and a different approach to gathering that evidence. So that if you're looking at the reactions, that kind of evidence you can gather pretty quickly when the experience is completed. The same would hold true with level two. Immediately after any sort of learning experience, I could really try to tap what skills the people had developed, what knowledge they had gained from it. What we stress in level two, though, is that that effort to gather evidence must be matched to the learning goals. That you can't always get it at it with paper pencil instruments, because sometimes it's a skill that requires demonstration. So it might mean that you would have to have a performance evaluation or a skill demonstration that people would look at with specific criteria, a rubric, for example, that would indicate what the critical aspects of that skill were and how those could be implemented with fidelity as they were intended. The organization support then too would deal with what you considered most important to be implemented. You'd have to develop clear criteria for high quality implementation and an outline specifically what learning outcomes you wanted to accomplish with the students. The second thing I hope they gain from it is that each of these levels builds on those that come before. And once it breaks down, it goes no further. So people have to have a positive reaction to any learning experience before they can learn anything. I mean, if they're sitting in the room and they're hungry, or if they're worried about their body temperature because the room is too cold, it's going to be difficult for them to learn. They have to learn some things well before you can ask for change on the part of the organization. The organization support and change has to be there in order to gain high quality implementation, and you clearly have to have the high quality implementation in order to get the results from the students. But the third aspect, and one that you brought up that I think is perhaps the most important, is that when you plan professional learning experiences for educators, you must reverse the order of those five levels. The first thing you have to consider is what impact you want to have on students and what evidence you believe best reflects that impact. Once that's decided, then you step back and say, if this is what we want to see from our students, what are the practices, the strategies, the techniques, the curriculum that we would have to see implemented in order to gain those results? Once that's established, you again step back and say, well, if this was going to be implemented well, what are the kinds of support we'd need from the organization in order for that to take place? What materials would the teachers need? What levels of technology do they need? What time do they require? What kind of support's necessary from their building leaders? Take another step back from that and say, well, if that is in place, what is the knowledge and the skill that the teachers have to have in order to be able to implement those things well? And then your final step back is to say, what are the professional learning experience could we plan to ensure the teachers develop that knowledge and skill? So this, I think, is the most critical dimension of it. A lot of people consider evaluation to be something that takes place only at the end, that after everything is completed, you swoop in and gather evidence and try to determine if things worked. What I've argued in presenting this model is if you plan well, evaluation takes care of itself. That probably 90% of the questions you would need to ask in any evaluation, you would ask before you start. So if beginning, you ask what impact you want to have on students, what evidence you would accept to verify that impact had been made, do all the stakeholders trust the same kind of evidence, or do you need to consider multiple indicators? All of those kind of things would be critical in evaluation, but if you plan carefully and well and reverse these stages or these levels in the planning process, all those things are considered before any level of implementation actually begins.
It's absolutely fascinating. And just when you were talking there about this idea of only evaluating at the end of projects, and I think back to some of the things that maybe I've been involved in, or certainly I've worked with people who've looked at, that yes, evaluation is sometimes seen as kind of a tacked on extra that we'll look at the end of a particular project. So just moving on from that a little bit, and it's picking up the same themes. So professional development has probably never been more valued than it is currently in the UK. So in 2016, the DfE produced standards for teachers' professional development. But from what I could gather, it stopped short of overtly suggesting, you know, evaluation to be part of that. So touching on the themes that you've talked about previously, why is evaluation so important in professional development, and why do you think it's so often overlooked?
Well, I think that we have come to the point in education today where there's a strong focus on accountability. People want to know that they are getting some results for the investment that is being made. And I think that is carried over to the investment that we make in the training of our educators. One of the things with which we struggled in education for a very long time is that we do not have strong evidence that over the course of their careers, teachers continue to improve. That this is known among researchers as what we call the teacher plateau. That in the first 3 to some argue up to 5 years in the profession, teachers vary a bit in their effectiveness with students. And this is effectiveness defined in terms of specific outcomes that we measure from the students, typically standardized assessment results. And so there's this initial period of some flexibility, teachers moving up and down, trying some things that work well, trying some things that fail miserably. But somewhere between the 3rd to 5th year, they settle into this fairly flat pattern of effectiveness that from year to year doesn't change very much. And this has been always cited as one of the sort of criticisms of professional development for educators. That if professional development was working, then we would not see that plateau. We would see, as teachers engage in professional development opportunities each year, that their effectiveness would continue to increase. And we didn't see that. But in recent years, I'd say maybe the past 5 to 7 years, there's been a turnaround in that. And we've been trying to look at what it is that contributes to that kind of continued growth. That it is certainly true that most teachers settle into that fairly flat plateau type pattern, but many teachers do not. And as we've been able to isolate those teachers who do not and see what it is in their experience that sort of leads to this continuous improvement, that each year they continue getting better, they're more effective with their students. Professional learning is a critical aspect of that. It's been rather surprising because some people have argued that the teachers that continue to grow have certain personality traits or certain dispositions that we can measure and predict whether they will continue to be more effective teachers or not. What this more recent research has shown, though, it doesn't really have anything to do with the kind of person they are or any personal kind of characteristic. It has a lot to do with the context in which they're working and the professional learning experiences that they have. And if those are well-designed, thoughtful, if they're focused on giving them the keys they need to really be effective in the context in which they're working, then this kind of improvement throughout the course of their careers can really be possible.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. So in terms of why it's overlooked, is it around the idea that we talked about previously that it's almost not considered the planning? I mean, I've seen the 5 levels used sort of systematically and through looking at, right, we'll look at level 1, then we'll work our way through. And is it because people do start with level 1 and try and progress through to 5 rather than going 5 to 1? Why do you think it is that it's so often overlooked?
Well, I think, as we discussed before, a lot has to do with that planning process. Mm-hmm. We, in the professional development field, fall under the same criticism of which we often accuse teachers. We fault teachers because we say that teachers plan in terms of what they are going to do, not in terms of what they're going to accomplish with their students. And we do the same when we plan professional learning experiences. We plan in terms of what we are going to do with the teachers or educators who would be involved. Rather, then going to the end and saying, what is it we want to accomplish with our students? And to use that as a starting point and coming back from there. Mm-hmm. So I think it's the change in our focus. We're pressing teachers to be more thoughtful about focusing their planning in terms of the learning outcomes of their students. We need to do the same for professional learning, that we need to plan by first focusing what impact we want to have on students and what evidence will we trust. Now, a critical aspect of that is to recognize that not all stakeholders trust the same evidence. I did a study a few years back where I took 15 different indicators of student learning. These ranged from things like scores on national examinations, scores on summative assessments or formative assessments, homework assignments, classroom quizzes, all sorts of things, 15 different indicators. And I gave this list to educators, and I said, we could argue that any of these would be considered legitimate source of evidence on student learning. What do you think is the most valid? Or what do you trust to really verify that this would show students have learned excellently? And I asked them to rank order those 15. So it meant that every individual had to compare each one with each other. After they ranked, I compared the rankings of teachers with the school leaders and school administrators. Do you know, they were almost exactly reversed.
Wow.
The administrators said, well, it's these large-scale assessments. You know, it's the national exams and the state or provincial exams. That's what's in a newspaper. That's what the Board of Education cares about. That's what government officials are questioning me about. Those need to be a priority for us. Teachers, on the other hand, said they are not all that important. We give them once a year. We don't get the results back for weeks or months. By that time, often my students are off with another teacher. I trust my own evidence. I trust the evidence that I gather from my students. So the powerful message of that, I think, for us in the area of professional development is that if not all stakeholders trust the same evidence, we have to gather multiple sources of evidence that would be valid and considered important to those various stakeholders that are involved in the process. And not think of just a single indicator, but multiple indicators that would give us a clearer picture of really what's going on.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, just moving on slightly. So one of the other roles that I've got at the moment, is to work with the Education Endowment Foundation as one of their assistant directors, one of their research schools. So the first question is, are you aware of the Education Endowment Foundation and the work that's going on in the UK with research schools?
Well, I recently looked into that. I was not as familiar with the work, though, prior to that. So I'm just learning about it now.
Okay, great. Well, in terms of what their kind of mission is to put what they're calling evidence-based best practice or evidence-informed practice into schools, and one of the guides that they've produced for primarily aimed at sort of school leaders, decision-makers within schools is a guide called the Implementation Guide, which is my personal favourite. So it looks at how to implement professional learning and other initiatives across the school and was pitched, as like I said, at decision-makers within schools. So this seems to sit across sort of levels 3 to 5 of your model. So they talk a lot about, and you mentioned at the beginning, this idea of fidelity data and this idea of making sure that what we're learning about is being translated to have an impact on student outcomes. So what would you see as, you know, sort of the best procedures to evaluate a professional learning program, maybe sitting around level 3?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that that work is particularly important because, again, it shifts our focus in the planning process to that impact on the students and to their learning, broadly defined to include a whole host of sort of cognitive or achievement as well as affective and behavioral kinds of outcomes. The important part here is that it's pressing educators to be more thoughtful and purposeful in their planning endeavors too. Oftentimes, we are greatly influenced by a dynamic speaker at a conference who is particularly effective in communicating your ideas, but whether those ideas have evidence behind them to say if you do this well in your classes that it's going to result in more students learning better. I know that as a teacher, when our school leader would go to a conference, we would always be concerned because we knew that that leader was going to come back with all new sorts of things they wanted to try simply because they had heard a presenter there. And whether there was evidence to support those ideas or not, or whether it was just the forcefully argued opinions on the part of the presenter, that was always in question. Mm-hmm. But I think another critical aspect for leaders here is a process of what researchers refer to as mutual adaptation. Mutual adaptation was a phrase that was coined in the late 1970s, but it's been with us since that time. And the idea here is that the change process involved with improvement efforts, it takes place in two directions. That if we have these evidence-based strategies that are out there, what will be necessary is that teachers, through their sort of professional judgment, be able to adapt those strategies to fit in the context where they're teaching. Mm-hmm. There is no sort of one size fits all. And teachers have to have the flexibility and the skill and the wherewithal to be able to take those and adapt it to their context, to the kind of students they have, to the level they're teaching, to the subject area where it might apply, to the background conditions that their students are facing. But at the same time, the teachers themselves have to adapt to that innovation. Now, what can happen is that the change can be thrown off balance by moving too far one way or the other. If the innovation is adapted too much, it may lose critical elements of its fidelity. Mm-hmm. If the individual teachers have to change too much, then what you do is you'll get implementation, but it'll be very mechanical. It won't have the necessary adaptation to fit the context. And so what's necessary for leaders to do is, in recognizing this notion of mutual adaptation, find that critical balance between those two to help the teachers who are implementing these ideas be able to adapt them to fit well in their context, but at the same time, help the teachers make the transition they need to make in order to use those new strategies and techniques with fidelity to gain the positive results that the evidence indicates will come from their use. So I think if we really helped our leaders develop that sense of critical balance, that we would be much more effective in our implementation efforts.
It's so interesting to listen to you talk about some of that, and I'm starting to see some of the roots of where parts of this implementation guide have possibly come from, because the language that you're using, the reports that you're talking about there, have been very much part and parcel of this. So there's a lot of talk around sort of faithful adoption of an evidence-based strategy, intelligent adaption of that, which is sort of the mutual thing that you talked about there, and also this idea of evidence-informed practice, now moving away from just evidence-based practice. It's using the professional judgment of the teacher to put that at the best for their classroom, their pupils in their classroom.
Well, I think another critical aspect of it that's often neglected is that we must build into the implementation of any new strategy or innovation a specific mechanism whereby teachers can gain evidence that it is making a difference for their students. I can recall several years ago I was being interviewed for what was called the Journal of Staff Development at the time. Now it's called the Learning Professional. But in this interview, I was asked, when teachers are involved with a new technique or new strategy, how soon should they see results? And at that time, good friends of mine were talking about how change was a slow process and it needed to be sustained over multiple years and you may not see the results right away. I said, they have to see results within 2 weeks. The interviewer was shocked. Because it was seemingly so different from everything that was being discussed in the field at the time. But based on the evidence that we have been gathering, it showed pretty clearly that teachers are very committed to the learning of their students. And if they do not get evidence fairly quickly that what they're doing is making a difference, they will revert back to the tried and true things they've always done. Not because they're afraid of change, but because they're so committed to learning of their students and they're unwilling to sacrifice their students for the sake of innovation. So what that implies to me is that in any strategy, if we think about what impact we're going to have on students and what evidence we would want to gather to show that impact was being made. Another aspect of that is, how can we gather that evidence pretty quickly? What sort of things could teachers be looking for to say that this is working, or if it's not working, what changes can we make in our implementation strategies to ensure that it's bringing the kind of results that the evidence upon which these strategies are based can be realized in that classroom? So it's, another transition of how we think about the not only evidence informing our practice, but then gathering evidence along the way to ensure the implementation is leading to the kind of results we know it can bring about.
Mm-hmm. Just on that, how much store would you put in something like lesson observations as a method of evaluating whether a particular professional learning practice has been put into place in the classroom?
Well, I think that those lesson observations from an outside observer can be good, especially looking at sort of gross indicators. But one of the things we sometimes miss in those is that we're looking in the wrong place. I think oftentimes when we do classroom observations, what we want to look at is not so much the teacher, but the students. I want to see if the students are actively engaged. Are they really thinking about the lesson content? Are they asking or discussing important questions? Are they engaged in sort of thoughtful kinds of inquiries, a part of a class versus just the commitment to memorization or providing the answer the teacher may want or what they believe the teacher wants? I know that I got into a bit of trouble here a few years back because I was able to show in a very extensive teacher evaluation system that had developed in the state where I live that a teacher could get a really excellent evaluation and there not be any students in the room. And I thought that was just a little bit crazy to think that you could get a really great evaluation as a teacher and there not be any students there. We really need to be looking at the students and the kind of things that they were doing as a part of the lesson. So even if the teacher's doing great things, but the kids are not engaged, if they're not involved, if they're not being thoughtful about the process, if they're not engaged in kind of a personal inquiry with regard to understanding, if they're not trying to link it to things they already know and how it matches or how it changes that, then all is lost. So I think those observations can be good, but we want to include in those observations very direct kinds of observations of the students and then gathering information from the students as to whether they're getting the things we'd hoped they'd gotten out of it.
So what are the methods in terms of, so I'll give you an example as best I can here. So something that's become rather popular in English schools at the moment is Rosenshine's Principles of Instruction. They seem to have come back through a book. Tom Sherrington has written a book where he's used those techniques and made them very applicable to classroom teachers. So lots of schools are adopting those as their professional development focus for the next year. So if they're going to look at, well, what impact might that have on student outcomes and start as we do with level five and work backwards. But if they wanted to assess whether or to distinguish whether that's actually happening in the classroom, alongside lesson observations, what kind of, you know, implementation data could, you know, people in charge of professional learning get from sort of, you know, other methods?
Mm-hmm. Well, I really like the work of Barak Rosenshine. He's been a scholar in the field of education that I've admired. In fact, I cited his work in my doctoral dissertation, which was a few years back. And he's been sort of instrumental in helping us to see through the fog of a lot of the sort of fancy things that go on to really what the core of teaching is really about. So I think that's a very powerful strategy and something to really pay attention to in close order. And I think that as we move in this direction, another thing that is sort of happening throughout a lot of the British schools is this notion of assessments guiding instruction. That instead of using assessments only for evaluating student performance, that we use them as learning tools. The notion of assessment for learning versus assessment of learning. I think that regular formative assessments can be a wonderful tool for teachers to gather information about what things are going on and what's coming across well and what's not. And in analyzing those results, it doesn't have to be any detailed statistical analysis. Simply making a tally of how many students missed a particular question on a formative assessment or were absent a particular prompt on a demonstration that might be there. If I come to a question on one of the formative assessments that I use for my graduate students at the university that have students in the class missed, I know that is not a student learning problem. That is a teacher problem. That's something I have to address. So the notion of using assessment results to guide not only what we do to help students learn better, but to guide improvements in our own instruction is I think, really critical to this. And I think that there's so much great work being done in the British schools that have sort of pressed in this direction. The other thing I think we're discovering from this, which I, in my personal experience, have gained too, is that I'm not very good at predicting those results. I used to think I was, but I've discovered that there are times I teach lessons and I think they are magnificent. Mm-hmm. I mean, I end that lesson and I say, oh, wow, I was on today. This was great. We should have video cameras rolling. This was wonderful. Then I ask my students about it later and they didn't get it. And I'm just shocked by that. So I think that when I found out they didn't get it, to understand it wasn't their fault, it was my fault. So to have a step back from that and say, maybe we're not as good at predicting those outcomes as we need to be, and we need to have evidence in order to better inform the decisions that we make to guide students in learning, but decisions we make to guide ourselves in reforming our own instruction and becoming better in the way we teach.
No, absolutely. Fantastic. So just got one more question, if that's okay. And then I'd like to, if you wouldn't mind, for you to be able to talk a little bit more about your current research and what kind of things you're going to be doing, because I believe you may be coming over to the UK fairly soon. So we'll touch on that hopefully towards the end. But the last question for this section is, for listeners, it's the dreaded Ofsted word coming up now. So Ofsted have got a new framework for inspection out this year, and they've written into their grade descriptors for a school to be outstanding that leaders ensure that teachers really receive focused and effective professional development. Teachers' subject, pedagogical and pedagogical content knowledge build and develop over time, and this consistently translates into improvements in the teaching of the curriculum. So firstly, in terms of what you've just said about student outcomes and sometimes looking at what the students are doing, what's your views on this? And in terms of, you know, does the teaching of the curriculum automatically improve those outcomes for pupils?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I would say that the policy is clearly informed by the research that's been done in this area. When we look at the content of the professional learning experience of educators, that consistently does yield results in terms of student learning outcomes. There are two things that are always a part of that. The first being to really focus on helping teachers develop deeper content knowledge of the subject area they're teaching. And the second is to focus on the way that is taught, to focus on those pedagogical concerns. Some people refer to this, and was developed by Lee Shulman some years ago, what he referred to as pedagogic content knowledge. But if knowing your subject in great depth was all that's necessary to become a very good teacher, then the finest examples of excellent teaching would be found at your nearest colleges and universities. But typically, if you want to see examples of very poor teaching, you need go no further than your nearest college or university. There's a very necessary transition between being a good expert in the subject and being able to communicate that effectively to people who learn in different ways, who acquire understanding in a different manner. So pedagogic content knowledge implies understanding your content in such depth that you can approach it from different perspectives. You can understand it in different ways. You can present it in a variety of modalities that make sense to students. We as teachers tend to present and teach as we learn best. But now that our focus has changed to having all of our students learn well, we need to understand that not all learn best in the same ways. And it's the responsibility of every teacher to be flexible in their perspectives to provide for those differences. So I think that that's a really critical element. It's certainly informed by an extensive research in this area. And to the extent that we can focus on those two things, I think it will take us a long way, really improving the quality of what we do for professional learning experiences for our teachers.
So in terms of, you know, does improving the teaching of the curriculum automatically improve outcomes for pupils? I know you've touched on it through the pedagogic content knowledge there, but, you know, have you got any views on that particularly?
Well, yeah, we know that just understanding your subject more deeply or the more complex aspects of the subject don't necessarily make you a better teacher of it. That it's the notion of, and I think this is one of the great things about sort of collaborative teaching opportunities or peer coaching, where often having teachers work together to think about instructional alternatives. We did a study some years ago where we were looking at the secondary teachers and those that were considered to be the most effective in their schools. We identified these teachers by asking the headmasters, the school principals, to identify who they thought were the very best teachers in the school. We asked the teachers to identify among their colleagues who they believed were the best teachers, and we also asked the students. Now, as you might guess, those three groups did not always agree on the same individuals, but in some cases they did. And we were able to identify this group of teachers who their principals said were amazing, their teaching colleagues said they were really terrific, and the students also verified these were really excellent teachers. And we interviewed them, we observed them, we tried to figure out what it was that they shared. And one of the characteristics that all seemed to have was this idea that they were keenly sensitive as to whether their lesson was coming across to their students. They had a keen sense of this perception of their students' understanding and whether it was coming across. And if it wasn't coming across, they had this amazing flexibility. They were able to go off in a different direction. They would try a different approach. Now, to my colleagues at that time, they were convinced this was an indication of creativity on the part of the teachers. So we administered to these teachers a variety of creativity tests and assessments. What we discovered is that they were no more creative than anybody else. In fact, on most of these creativity measures, they were slightly below average. What marked them as different is that they spent more time planning their lessons than did their colleagues, and they planned differently. When they planned, they were always trying to think of two or three different ways to get at the same idea or the same topic. They didn't have one lesson plan or one approach. They had a variety of ways of getting at it. And my colleagues were very depressed about this because they thought we had identified this unique characteristic shared by these amazing teachers. But to me, this was the most optimistic, hopeful thing we could find, because what it showed is it's not who they are that makes them so great, it's what they do. And if it is what they do, then those are the things that perhaps all of us can do. So it opened this door to all these wonderful things that we might be able to help all teachers become more like these outstanding teachers. And I think that's the promise that we have. There are certainly a lot of things that influence student learning that are outside of our control. But among the school factors that do influence student learning, teachers are clearly the most powerful. And if we can really help teachers incorporate some of these ideas, learn how to plan better, and learn how to incorporate the ideas that the really stellar, outstanding teachers in their field incorporate, then we have this potential of making amazing improvements.
Fantastic. And what a perfect way to end that part of the interview. So thank you very much for that. Would you mind if we just talk briefly about your current research? So if I've got this right, I've been looking on various different things, and you're looking, your research at the moment is currently focusing on the way that teachers grade and how teachers gather information. Could you tell listeners a little bit more about that research that you're doing at the moment?
Yes. This stems from some of my earliest experiences as a teacher. I can recall in my very first year of teaching, I was a middle grade teacher, and in grade 8 it was the practice of our school to give final examinations to our students. This was a typical high school activity, and we felt that by doing it for grade 8 students, we would better prepare them for that environment. And I recall the first year doing this, because as my students, grade 8 students, were coming into my class to take their final exam, I was greeting them at the door, and I had one student come down the hall who was just, she had been actually brilliant. Everything she had done the entire school year was just phenomenal. She was clearly outstanding, had an amazing understanding of mathematics. And as Jessica came through the door, I said hello to her, and I said, "Jess, did you study for your exam?" And she turned to me and said, "No, Mr. Guskey, I didn't." And I was shocked. I was just shocked. And I turned to her and said, "Jessica, I don't understand. This is a really important part of your grade. How could you not study for your exam?" And she looked at me rather quizzically, and she said, "Well, Mr. Guskey, I worked it out. I only need a 51% on the final exam to keep my A. I don't have to study to get a 51%. This eighth grader had worked it out actually to the 10th decimal place, what she needed to do on her final exam to keep her grade of A. And she was shocked that I didn't get it. And I was just stunned, because it made me realize that my grading practices had completely perverted how this brilliant young woman was going about learning in my class. To her, it wasn't about what new skills or knowledge she'd acquired. It was about getting the high grade. And she had done her job and was surprised that I didn't recognize it. So from that, I've always been fascinated by this notion of grading and how we do grade and what policies and practices that we provide in our classes. So in recent years, we've been looking into this. We find that there's an amazing history of research in grading. We just put together a book with my colleague Susan Brookhart, where we sort of compiled the last 100 years of research on grading to discover that we know a lot about this process. We know a lot about what works well and what doesn't, but there's also not another area in education where the gap between our knowledge base and our practice is greater than in the area of grading. Most of what we do in grading is not based on evidence or research. It's based on tradition. We do things this way because we've always done it that way. And so our work now is trying to challenge some of those traditions, looking at this knowledge base and finding how it can bring evidence to bear to improve the policies and practices we use in the way we grade and evaluate our students in school.
Fantastic, fantastic. And, you know, that's definitely something that I know there'd be a lot of interest in terms of the UK for that sort of work. So thank you again for that. Right, just a last thing, if we may. So is there a possibility, I read, that you may be visiting the UK and London in this autumn, or sorry, fall?
Well, arrangements are still tentative. I've been in conversations with the American School of London about working with some of their faculty. They're looking particularly to change their grading policies and practices. I've had wonderful opportunities to exchange ideas with some professional colleagues there in the UK, and have been quite taken by their work and the thoughtfulness of a lot of the work that's been going on. So I look forward to that opportunity. Nothing definite has been arranged yet, but I'm hoping that we can make plans. And if there are others with whom I might be able to work during that time, I'd certainly look forward to the opportunity.
Fantastic. And I just want to tell you how important the work that you've been doing. I'm sure that you're aware of the impact that's had across policies and day-to-day work of teachers right across the UK. So it's been an honour to speak to you this afternoon. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And hopefully you'll be coming over to the UK in October, and let me get a chance to come down and meet you in person possibly.
Phil, I would look forward to that. And thank you. It's really been an honor to be a part of this podcast, and I'll look forward to that opportunity to continue our discussion.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Take care. Bye. Such an insightful interview with Tom there, and I'm so grateful for Tom for sharing his knowledge with us today. So into the shameless plug section. We're changing the order slightly with Nail as Natter over the summer, so podcasts may not be every week due to holidays, but coming up we have Mark McCourt talking about his new book, Mastery, Emma Turner about New Ed and the importance of CPD for ITT and early careers teachers. Kat Howard on research-informed practice to reduce teacher workload. Patrice Bain on her new book, Powerful Teaching. And Ross Morrison McGill on his new book, Just Great Teaching. I also have a new website where you can find out about blogs, articles and previous podcasts. And that's www.nailersnatter.co.uk. I'd also be honoured if you would consider becoming a patron of the podcast. And if you are interested, then follow links on the aforementioned website or head over to www.patreon.com and hopefully contribute the cost of a flat white to the production of this podcast. Finally, whatever you're doing during the summer, have a great break, spend time relaxing and recharging those batteries. So thank you for listening and see you next time on Nailers Natter.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.